everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's February 2024, and you're listening to episode 381, which is a conversation about how to answer the question, why do Christians try to impose their morals on others? And this article is the first in an ongoing series of articles that we're calling Back to the Basics of Apologetics. On this episode, I'm joined by Jay Watts, who is the founder and president of Merely Human Ministries, Inc., an organization founded to equip Christians and pro-life advocates to defend the intrinsic dignity of all human life. Jay has written an online exclusive feature article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called Christianity is Better: What Place for the Christian in a Post-Christian Political World? And you can read it for free at our website, equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Jay, it's good to have you back on the podcast again.
It's great to be back, as always.
Well, as I mentioned in the intro, we are starting a brand new ongoing series. It'll be an occasional series that we're calling Back to Basics, Apologetics. And we're getting back to some of the questions that are frequently asked. And for some of us who've been in this work for a long time, they're the typical questions we get asked a lot. But for the younger generations, and especially for some of the younger generations, well, the millennials are in their 40s now, but especially for Gen Z that have grown up very unchurched, these are all questions that they have. And I find that they're asked many times in the comments sections of various articles if Christianity is being covered on a particular issue, and specifically abortion, which is why I wanted to talk to Jay today, and he wrote this article, because this is one of those frequently asked questions by non-Christians and, of course, by younger folks, and that is, why do Christians try to impose their morals on others? And I know in your experience, you come across this as you speak to college and high school students on campus. So how often are you asked this question?
Almost every time you have, it doesn't come up often as much in Q&A, but what happens is afterwards, people will line up after the public part of it is done to ask questions they didn't feel as comfortable talking about it. Sometimes it comes up in Q&A, but almost every time, either in Q&A or in the post conversations, the post-talk conversations, they want to know why I feel like it's appropriate to force my beliefs on other people. It's fine for me to have personally held beliefs, but it's not fine for me to force them to live by those same beliefs, and particularly in younger people, because they have been oftentimes, when you're talking about universities or even in high schools, we're talking about Christian high schools, by the way, and Catholic high schools. The students that I talk to have a very low view of the relationship between Christianity and history. They see it as an oppressive force, as a colonializing force. They see it as something that suppresses the sexual freedom of people. They see it as something that is misogynistic. So they have this low view of Christianity. And so when they see or hear me speaking about ethics or morality, at which time, by the way, I'm never talking about it from a Christian perspective. I'm never forcing Christian beliefs. I'm talking about it from philosophy and science. But even there, behind there is a level of distrust that I'm trying to force my views or my beliefs about the world onto them. And they have a deep question. Why does what I believe have anything to do with them and how they ought to live their life? So it is very common. The most common objection you get actually as well, I always talk about this idea of retreat. Once they start to lose arguments, when they're trying to engage in the kind of marketplace of ideas and they start to feel themselves losing, they oftentimes retreat back to this as a reflexive thing as well. Once they've lost ground on the intellectual front, they'll say, well, you don't have any right to force your beliefs, your Christian views on me and how I live my life if I reject those views.
Well, in your article that you wrote for us to answer this question, which is your approach is probably different than maybe some people are expecting, you're focusing on politics in particular, and I want to talk about your intro in a moment, but why did you focus on politics in your article to answer this question? Because I think that's an area where people for sure feel like Christians are imposing their morals on other people.
Yeah, I remember speaking at a school, I believe it was in Indiana, and a young man, after I was talking about the moral case against abortion, this idea of equal human dignity and the value of human life, he raised his hand and said, this is all politics and I don't care about politics. And I thought that was fascinating for one for two reasons. Number one, because they hadn't been talking about politics, but he did understand something, that the place where personal beliefs intersect with the community or in our society is the political realm. It's the place where we go from saying, I have personally held beliefs about what it means to be a human being, or have personally held beliefs about who counts as a member of the human family, or what we're allowed to do to other human beings. And then we go to society through politics and say, as a community, we should not be doing these things to other human beings. And then we have to restrict certain practices, or that we have to recognize certain relationships differently than others. And there's an idea now that people hold that aren't familiar with the relationship between politics and moral beliefs and theological beliefs, that these realms exist separately. But there is no way for me to impose my beliefs without there becoming a political component to it whatsoever. I could sit around my house and believe whatever I want to believe. And for the most part, people will leave me alone. We're seeing that being pushed back a little bit. But once I step into the public and say these things are true or beautiful or good, and it is more than just something that I need to be personally holding on to my own, it's something that we as a society have to recognize, or a society that's improperly ordered will not be able to sustain itself or to continue to exist. If you have a bunch of immoral laws that are separate from good philosophy and good theology, then ultimately you're building a society that can't sustain itself. So why do we go to politics? Because the division happens once we decide that the things that we believe are so important that they're necessary to be communicated to society, and it's necessary for the good of all, for human flourishing, that we recognize certain truths about humanity and our obligations and duties to one another, and that those things are going to be settled as a community in the political realm. And that's where that division really starts to get heated up. That's where people get angry, because they want there to be certain safeguards against the beliefs of others to be able to compel them one way or another. But it's just the practice of politics that we have to decide what is good, what is true, in a marketplace of ideas where the ideas are given a competitive chance to see whose is superior. What is most going to contribute to human flourishing?
So on that note, your article in the introduction begins by noting there's been an effort by three known, well-known Christian leaders to address the divisive nature of, you know, we're in 2024, it's going to be an election season, and you know, among even other fellow Christians. And so why would that particular effort by those three leaders to work against division, specifically in the Christian community, why would that draw criticism from other Christians? I think that's a little fascinating. Some people would say, well, that is capitulating maybe to cultural pressures as to why they're teaming up together.
Yeah, this is Curtis Chang, who is a advisor, Duke Divinity School professor, former evangelical pastor, identifies himself as a Democrat, but has very powerful evangelical leanings. Editor-in-chief of Christianity Today, Russell Moore, who used to be the head of the ERLC in the Southern Baptist, and New York Times columnist David French, who was a member of the Alliance Defending Freedom, has tried cases before the Supreme Court for freedom of religion. So you have these three people who are very famous, very well-known Christians. And going back to what I was saying a second ago, now they're looking at the landscape and they're saying politics right now, as far as the attempts for Christians to engage the culture through the political process, is causing such division. And these men say they've experienced this division with loss of friendship, with problems in their churches. All of these things are things that they've seen. And so they see as a key problem, they identify the major problem that they want to solve with what they call their after-party curriculum, which is aimed at evangelical churches. And so they've given a church curriculum with this idea of, how do we help people, whatever their political beliefs, navigate this coming political season in a way that won't hurt their witness, that won't destroy their relationships, that won't divide their church. And so they have developed this called the after party curriculum that they're giving to churches, and they're giving it away. I mean, they have funding right now that is allowing them to give it away through the political season, through this election cycle. You can access it for free. And it's interesting. Why does it cause division? It causes for two reasons. Number one is a part of this, what we're talking about here. Within the Christian body, there's a tremendous amount of distrust that has been, let's say, cultivated over the last couple of election cycles. Some of it has to do with the divided nature of how people feel about former President Trump, with the divided nature of that feel about him coming back, with the passions that people feel about the evil of what they would say, the evil of the Democratic platform. So the platform of the Democratic Party, whatever you think of any individual person within the Democratic Party, and you may like a Democratic candidate or a Democratic politician, somebody in the Democratic Party, but they serve the platform. If the platform has certain statements about abortion or the value of human life, there's a passionate resistance to that platform. So you'll have people who see their job in politics as to vote to limit the evil of the Democratic platform as it exists in its language about abortion. So you have all of these people with, and then of course you have other issues, obviously, that have come up over the last several years where they feel like the Christian views have been lost through this political process. And now the people winning the largely in elections are people who are antithetical to Christian views. And so those people tend to think that it's necessary to have a very confrontational stance on this. We're in a culture war. We're fighting for the nation and for society. And it hasn't been decided yet. And we can still win this thing. And then you have people who are saying, we live in a post-Christian culture. It's largely over. Our views are more marginalized. You have people that say, however we're going to win, we can't compromise ourselves by aligning ourselves with evil people. All of these things are coming together and it's built up a sense of distrust. And so as they're coming forth and saying, we want to work on division, some other people see that and their reaction to that. And we have several bloggers. And I mentioned one particular person in the article who's written my article that's written in response to that, Megan Basham from First Things, where they say, look, what you're trying to do by highlighting or prioritizing fighting against division is you're trying to lower the necessity to engage, whatever the cost to our relationships, with the truth in a society that's losing that. And so what they see is three people who they think that they've, and there's, again, I said, there's issues with Trump. Each one of those three people do not like Donald Trump. And the people that see Donald Trump as someone who is championing their views in an aggressive manner see three people whom they have in some way or another grown to distrust, now standing up and saying, don't prioritize engagement, prioritize peace. Don't prioritize the preservation of truth, prioritize a lack of divisiveness and unity and things that we can do within the church. And they fear that by giving that to churches, that they're going to encourage pastors at a time where they think pastors need to be bold to prioritize unity and peace. And so that even as they're trying to fight division, and if I always try my best to take people at their word, unless you see some reason not to. And if they say, look, we see divisiveness as the major problem and we're trying to address it in the church because we don't want to see people go through the painful breakup of their church relationships or their friends and longtime friendships because of this. But even as they say we're fighting against divisiveness, it creates divisiveness because that's just the nature of the political world that we live in right now. So much distrust. So much past hurt for things that people have said about each other. And those three have said things that have really upset other Christians. They feel like they've been categorized large groups of people who supported Trump with some nuance or some idea about why they were doing it. And they feel like they were lumped in with some bad people by those fellow Christians who ought to have given them the benefit of the doubt for why they were doing the things that they were doing. And so past political clashes have led to this deep-seated distrust. So even as you try to address division in the Christian body as to how we're engaging politically, it's just creating more division. It just highlights that division. People are just getting, they just at their foundation, they can't trust each other on this.
Even though the Christian Research Journal is now online, completely free without a paywall, no subscription needed, and this is a place where you can access on our website, equip.org, more than 45 years of content. That's thousands and thousands of articles completely free to you. We would still ask that you would consider partnering with us. We have new content every single week, a brand new article. We do believe that our authors should be paid a remuneration for their research and work for us. And we continue to bring articles
in classic apologetics and Christian living and cultural apologetics and ethics from a Christian perspective and all kinds of different content to equip you in your faith and to be able to share your faith and grow closer to Christ. And so we ask that you would partner with us by giving us a tip. It could be something very simple like $3, $5, $10, something that you could give us, maybe skip something in your entertainment budget for the week and give us a tip, which you can easily do at our website, equip.org. Go on there, click on journal, and at any one of the landing pages for Postmodern Realities, if you click on that, you will find a link to give us a tip. In addition, we would always ask that you would consider taking some of your time, which is completely free to you, and just would you please give us a rating or review, particularly on Apple Podcasts, because as you know, the internet runs on algorithms, and those algorithms favor things that people think are popular to suggest them to other people. So would you please tell people why you listen to this podcast or give us a starred review? So now back to my conversation with Jay Watts as we talk about how to answer the question, why do Christians try to impose their morality on others? Now, I want our listeners to know, I am going to ask Jay about the issue of, you know, church and state. But before I do that, Jay, I wanted to ask you because, you know, as you describe this, I think some Christians are thinking the fact that they're even having this curriculum just shows how far off course we've gotten, because the mission of the church is spiritual. It's to preach the gospel. It's to do evangelism. It's not political. We should not be involved. That's where some of the more progressive denominations have gone off track, because they've made social issues or political issues primary rather than the spiritual mission of the church to preach the gospel. And so as we talk about that, I'm sure there's some Christians that are like, I don't even know, you know, why we should even think about this, because we're getting so far afield from what the church should be about.
Yeah. And I think that's a fair question. I think that, and that's why we have to understand what politics is for the Christian. We have views of what it means to be a human being, right? I mean, and that is at root for a Christian. We think of the image bearer of God, the Imago Dei. We have an understanding of how other human beings ought to be treated. And we come from there's been a tradition, and there's several books that you can read about the sort of the loss of the, what we would call the corrective nature of scripture on most human beings in the United States. Like there was a time where the United States, when you come out of certain times, like the Great Awakening or things like that, where you have a way that scripture can be seen as corrective on the world around us. And whereas like Jacques Barzun, from Dawn to Decadence, where he talks about the loss of that, where you've seen that no longer in society or Western society is scripture a corrective. No longer can you tell somebody, well, the scripture says this, so we should correct our behavior to live in accordance with the scripture. So why should we care? Because the gospel is our primary. I mean, well, if we leave the people of the world in the United States, let's just talk about our country. If we leave them to be the victims of bad policy that was crafted by people who have a bad view of other human beings, a faulty understanding of what it means to be a human being, a faulty understanding of what our duties and obligations are to other people, then we're not being good and faithful stewards of the word of God. Now, I was just talking, by the way, to some very, very important people in politics in my state last week, and we were all having a discussion about this because I was working on this article for you guys, and I wanted to talk to some other people about it. And so I got a room full of people and some very influential people who have asked to remain anonymous, but that have high positions. And all of them said the same thing as we're discussing this. This isn't about winning or losing. And I think that's where the engagement with politics in a proper manner becomes the most important, in the sense of understanding that there's a faithfulness to Christ that we have to do in order that we have to live by to, in order to make sure that the people in our society are living under just laws. And this isn't new. I mean, this isn't new, right? I mean, Martin Luther King Jr. was explicitly Christian in his language about why Black Americans shouldn't be treated the way that they were treated. The motivation, and interestingly enough, one of the things that I wrote about when I was much younger was how Gandhi co-opted the language of Jesus, even though he rejected Jesus as Lord, he co-opted the language of Jesus so that people could see injustice. He used the teachings of Jesus to highlight injustice so that people could see when they were living outside of accordance of just laws. Going back to slavery in the United States and the abolitionist movement, you had people like Harriet Tubman, incredibly deeply motivated by her Christian beliefs. If you read the narrative of Frederick Douglass, deeply motivated by his ideas of what it means to be a valuable human being and the injustice of slavery. Go to Thomas Clarkson and William Wilberforce and the abolitionist movement in England, where they fought to change laws, laws that were unjust and were subjugating entire classes of human beings to the most vile and evil mistreatment, one of the worst things we've ever done to any other group of human beings, through the act of the slave trade. And so there have been throughout history Christians who have understood that it's not enough for me to be right and to hold correct views of other human beings and let then society just mistreat whole categories of human beings and talk about what I talk about the most often, which is the issue of abortion. If you're not one of the million human lives that are being destroyed through the practice of abortion in the United States every year, or the 70 million, around 70 million that are being destroyed worldwide every year, then you might have the luxury of being able to say, these are private, personally held beliefs, and we have to focus on the gospel and not worry about those things. But the gospel requires me to love my neighbor as myself, and so I have to come outside of myself and to convince my neighbor to love his neighbor as himself. And if I can convince enough of them, then we can get good law. Now, here's the thing. We don't have to have everybody agree with good law. That's the whole point of law. You're never going to get 100% agreement of society. The reason that we make things illegal is because we recognize we'll never get 100% of the people in society to agree with us one way or another. But if we can get a critical mass to agree that there are certain ways that we shouldn't treat other human beings, and other human beings have basic fundamental rights that they have by virtue of what they are, the imago Dei, and that we have a duty and responsibility to treat them, not the least of which is just not to kill them, treat them a certain way, then I go out and I try to convince a certain number of people of those truths. And I'm inspired by that, by the great commandment to love my neighbor as myself. And so I think there is the problem if we think that this is something other than serving the gospel. I don't see, and I'm not the only, and I talk about this at length in other parts, and we can get to some of those people later and some of the arguments they put forth, but I don't understand how we can believe, like that young man who could say, politics have nothing to do with me. Politics is nothing more than how we work out our morality in the public sphere, in the marketplace of ideas. It's nothing more or less than how we take what our most deeply held and cherished beliefs and take them to society so that we can say, I think this is a better way, and that's the whole title of my article, is Christianity is Better. This is a better way to organize society than other ways. And if you see the rightness in those ways, if you see the goodness of grace and mercy, or you see the goodness of justice, or you see the goodness of objective morality, if you see the goodness of all of those and understand that that is better for society, then you have to go out and try to convince your neighbor to treat their neighbor better.
So I think a typical follow-up question to the original question of, you know, why do Christians try to impose their morals on others, at least in the United States, people will follow that up with, well, we have the separation of church and state, and that the framers of the U.S. Constitution intended that there be a wall between religion and the church and, you know, matters of government. And so what did the founding fathers think about the relationship between church and state? Because that's the number one thing. Why shouldn't there be prayer in the public square, separation of church and state? Why should, you know, Christians not try to influence from their particular worldview, separation of church and state, because they're influenced by the church? So let's go back. What did the founding fathers think about this relationship between the church and government?
It's interesting. If you read, I found two tensions and reading multiple books and trying to get back, and even talking to those gentlemen that I told you I talked to. One of them is a president of a university. The other one is a state Supreme Court judge. And I was asking them similar questions, and it was, they were speaking in accordance with these other books that I've read, these two tensions that exist. One of them was, obviously, these people had escaped governments where there were state religions, and they wanted to practice their own religion in the way that they wanted to practice it without the interference of the state. And so at the beginning, one of the tensions is from the framers of the U.S. Constitution. And there's an example that was given, I believe, by Robert Tracy McKenzie in his book, in McKinsey, We the Fallen People, where he talks about a point. No, this was actually in Thomas Kidd's book on liberty. He talks about that there was a point where Congregationalists and Baptists in Virginia were being oppressed by from being able to evangelize in public by the Anglican majority. And that Thomas Jefferson and James Madison fought for the freedom of these Baptists to be able to evangelize, even though it was not the way the Anglicans would want them to handle their religious practice. And they said, and that's where James Madison comes up with the phrasing, the free exercise of religion versus the idea of religious tolerance. He said, it's very important that we understand that the government is not in a position to tolerate religion. You have the right to practice religion as you see the free exercise of religion, which goes both in a Virginia Declaration of Rights and in the First Amendment of the Constitution, the United States, and the Bill of Rights. He uses that term free exercise because he wants to fight against the idea that the government is in any position to tolerate or be intolerant to religious practice. What he says is that government has nothing to say about this. Human beings, citizens of the United States, have the right to the free exercise of their religious practice without interference of the state. So that's one of the things. They obviously didn't want another situation where there was a state religion that was compelling people to practice religion in a certain way. Now, the other thing was that, and this was interesting. This came up when I was talking to those gentlemen and wanted to fact check some things with them, but their extensive reading in these in the history of this. They said that it is absolutely true that the early colonialists and the framers of the Constitution were very concerned about the corruption of religion if it got involved in politics, in that if any religious body became too embroiled into political bodies, that it would ultimately be a corrupting force on the religious practice itself, and that it would sow distrust against religious institutions, which they saw as vital and important to organizing society. So there was obviously fear, not just of an institution dominating people or of an institution dominating government and then taking the practice of government and turning it into the practice of religion, but also the idea that the practice of the mixing of the two too much would ultimately corrupt the religious institution. So this was about institutions, though, and this is what's important, because it would never have occurred to the early framers of the Constitution to bar religious individuals from being able to express themselves in the public and to try to convince people to pass certain laws, because so many people at that time were religious and deeply religious individuals, and they were not like, I mean, we always want to look at the framers of the Constitution as they were. I mean, originally they gave very specific guidelines for who they thought should be allowed to vote and have a voice in the government, right? It was mostly white and landowners and people who didn't have debt or weren't beholden to other people and men. So they had they didn't have a problem saying these people aren't allowed to have a voice in government. They were very clear about who they thought should and shouldn't be allowed to have voice in government at the time. However much it may have been discussed, where they landed on was the idea of people that weren't financially beholden to other people, people who owned land, and for the most part, white men, certainly not women, certainly not slaves. And so when they make these laws, at no point did they say, oh, and we don't want religious people to have a voice in the government, because many of them were religious people, and many of them were motivated to be active in politics because of their religious beliefs. And many of them were arguing things that they believed by virtue of those religious practices or those religious beliefs, they would be good for society. So the idea of the separation of church and state had two particular goals. One of them was so that the state and the institutions couldn't corrupt each other through too intimate a relationship with each other by giving too much power, political power, to religions. And the other was to protect the individual from dominance from a state religion, but it was never intended to block an individual who was motivated by their religious beliefs to seek to advance ideas about the good and flourishing society that may have been grounded in their religious beliefs, but what they genuinely believed would be best for all if practiced by society under law.
So in your article, you mention various different scholars, and you actually even mentioned the 20th century poet T.S. Eliot. Our listeners may not know if they don't know about poetry. He died back in the 1960s. But you mentioned these people making the case that everyone is practicing some sort of religion, that no one has a worldview that's completely secular. So what does T.S. Eliot mean when he says, you know, he's talking about people and he calls many people modern pagans and they're not purely secular. Is that true? Are any of us 100% secular, even the people who would reject Christianity?
Yeah, and you hear this also from Robert George, from Francis Beckwith, from writers like Stephen D. Smith and his book Pagans and the Christians in the City. Even you hear this, and like T.S. Eliot said, the conflict is not going to be against religious believers and non-believers. It's going to be against religious believers and modern pagans. And what do you mean? And what they mean by that? And that's a theme, by the way, of Pagans and the Christian and Christians in the City by Stephen Smith, which is a great book. But in that book, he talks about this idea that everybody who comes to the marketplace of ideas, to the public square, everyone who comes to the political body to advance ideas is coming with some view of what it means to be a human being, of what it means to have a relationship with society. And when you come to that, and Francis Beckwith would use abortion as a case, right? Where he would say, they're going to come and they're going to say that they understand what it means to be a human being and who has rights. And they're going to divide up the human family between person who has rights and human beings who are merely human, who don't have rights. And those that are just merely human, we are free to do with them and do to them whatever we wish to do. And so he would highlight them and he would say, those people we can abuse, those human lives we can destroy. They do not deserve any respect from us. They do not deserve the protection under law from us. And he would say, look, when they do this, and this is the point that T.S. Eliot was making, calling them modern pagans, they're not appealing to some secular view that has a privileged platform for which it can see what human beings truly are versus what religious people may think they are, or Christians may think they are, or Jewish people may think they are. What they are doing is they are bringing in a view of what it means to be a human being that they are taking from their own philosophy, from their own views that are not in any particular way especially secular. And they're saying, this is what we think human beings are, and they're giving them the title of secular. But T.S. Eliot, to his point about being modern pagans, what he would say, what they're really trying to do is elevate themselves and the importance of their experience and their moment. What he would say is that there's the difference between the worship of the transcendent and the worship of the immanent, the things that are happening here and now. I worship the things around me. And he would say the modern pagan may not be as overtly pagan as the ancient pagans, but they are still obsessed with the imminent, and they're still elevating the imminent over everything else. My beliefs, my desires, my will, my hopes, my fears, all of those give me latitude to destroy other human beings. And he would say, this isn't secular. This is just the elevation of self, the elevation of imminent, the elevation of the moment over everything else, over the transcendent. It's a different religion that they're bringing to the marketplace, a different view of human beings, but it doesn't enjoy any special category that leaves it without criticism or blame. It doesn't get to claim the mantle of secularism and then say, by virtue of us being secular, we're superior to those people who have a different view of human beings that may be grounded in their beliefs as human, as religious believers, but that they can argue without appealing to their sacred text, which is what we do. And they don't get to say, well, you don't get to bring that because your view is quote unquote religious and ours is secular. They don't have a secular view. There's no such thing as a truly secular view of what it means to be a human being, unless you're embracing something like a materialistic, naturalistic view that there is no value. There is no human being. There is no purpose. There is no will. There is no mind. There is none of those things. There is just matter and atoms colliding with each other. And then that's even there you're bringing in some explanation of the biggest questions in the world and trying to explain what it means to be to exist in this time, in this community, and what the best way for us to manage our relationships through law will be. They would say that there is no way to do this without trying to attack big questions for which you will never be able to point to like empirical research in the scientific process and say, see, it's settled what human beings are and what our value is and what our duties are to one another. Those simply aren't scientific questions. They're philosophical questions. They're theological questions. And they have to be decided on a level playing field where every idea gets the opportunity to compete against the other. You can't just dismiss certain ideas because you have deemed yours superior because you think they're secular versus what other people would deem them as. That's why I think T.S. Eliot's saying, look, they're just modern pagans. They're not it's not really secular views. It's just the elevation of self, the elevation of the immanent, the worship of everything immediate to them, and with the denial of the transcendent. It's just a different religious view.
So at the very beginning of this podcast, you mentioned people who think that Christians should prioritize peace over political activism. And in fact, we recently had a summary critique about a Christian theologian who's really talking about prioritizing peace. If anyone has not listened to the episode about Scott McKnight, I suggest that you listen to that. But are there also Christians who argue something like the opposite of that, that we have a duty to engage in politics to be faithful followers of Christ? So they would reject the church's mission being primarily and exclusively only the gospel, but they would say, well, we have a duty to be part of the conversation in the public square. We have to engage in that way as Christians.
Yes. Professor Robert George from Princeton University, he has an entire chapter in his book, The Clash of Orthodoxies, devoted to the idea that for him, now he's a Catholic, and he's saying that to be a good Catholic, and he quotes John Paul II, former Pope John Paul II, extensively in this. He said, to be a good Catholic, we are required to engage our community, because he says that we have to, Catholics lean heavily on a principle of subsidiarity. And what they mean by that is that there are the most local institutions are the best institutions for handling a problem. For example, the most local institution is the individual. So if I have a problem, the best solution for that would be for me to handle it on my own. If I can't handle it on my own, the next most local institution would be my family. My family should be able to help me, which places a strong priority on us keeping strong families in the United States, because strong families mean strong communities. Because if I don't have to go to the community, if my family can help me when I have problems and I don't require the community's help or interceding in my problems, then that's good for everyone. And so the family needs to be strong and needs to be intact for the purposes of taking care of people. So that would be the next institution. Then beyond that, if the family can't handle it, you would go to a place like the institution of the church. And so this idea is, they only want to go to certain institutions when it's necessary. And the last of those would be something like a strong government to be able to help with people. But it does recognize that there are legitimate places where we need the government to help people. That's just what they're going to be able to do more efficiently and better than smaller institutions. There are places where it's necessary to appeal to the government to establish just society, to pass laws to protect people from being treated unjustly, to stop abuse, to set things right that have been wrong in the past, to protect people from tyrants and things. There are things that are the legitimate concern of the government. John Paul II, Robert George both said that. So in order for us to have a just government, which we need, because we have to have them to handle certain things, government is necessary on a large level. It's necessary in order for us to protect the best version of government, or to create the best version of government. We need the best people that we can get involved in government. And so Robert George and John Paul II would say throughout that, or would argue throughout that chapter, that as Catholics, it is necessary as part of our faith and our witness to be out there working within the government to create the best and most just government imaginable, because government's necessary and we can't just get rid of it. And so being a necessary institution for human flourishing, we have to do everything that we can to make sure that it's populated and directed by moral people who are looking out for the good of those who live under it. And it's not just Catholics. I mentioned Megan Basham earlier, who was very critical of the After Party, and she's very critical of the funding of it and where it's coming from. But she makes clear in a podcast episode that she does with another social media influencer, where she said, I don't want to give the impression here that I'm just attacking them for the sake of attacking them. She said, look, she takes very seriously this same view. We have a responsibility and duty to engage in politics, because government is necessary and it's a powerful force in our life for establishing justice in the world around us. And so in order for us to love our neighbors as ourselves, to fulfill the great commandment that was given to us, love the Lord our God and love our neighbors as ourselves, we have to love our neighbors in every possible way. That means being there for them personally. That means helping them out as much as we can. And that means making sure that the institutions that exist to help our neighbors, even those neighbors that we don't know that live in communities far from us, the institution that exists to help them in ways that we can't is run by just people who, for whom human flourishing is a priority, and have put in place systems that will do the best that they can to preserve peace and justice and all of those things. So yeah, you have people who say we shouldn't be involved in politics. We should prioritize peace. But the counter to that is, if we're not involved in politics, then we leave a vacuum for people who have a low view of human value, or if people have faulty views of human value, or even worse, people who are going to use other human beings as a means to accomplish goals without regard to them. There's a Paul Johnson, an intellectual, he wrote a book called Intellectuals, historian Paul Johnson. And in there, he describes or defines intellectuals as people who love ideas more than they love people. And they would like to see that their ideas are activated through the body, the political body, without regard to what it'll ultimately do to the people who live under those laws. John Stonestreet, who is at Breakpoint, often says, you know, bad ideas have victims, right? He's like, bad ideas have consequences and they have victims. And so if we leave the political field altogether to prioritize peace and a lack of divisiveness, we leave it for people who will use it to do wrong, either intentionally or unintentionally. And so you have, and I'm one of those people who believe wholeheartedly that we have a responsibility and duty to fill that role, to engage with a necessary institution that exists to make sure that the people who are working within it are moral people with an idea towards the good of human flourishing and how we can use government to accomplish that goal and limit it in so much as it doesn't become something that starts to interfere with areas that have no business, that the government has no business in getting involved in, which is the other danger. If you leave it to people who see government as a means to power, then they use that power to advance all sorts of ideas beyond the legitimate use of governmental power. We need good people in government who have good ideas about what it means to be a human being and who want to see those ideas put under law so that all of us flourish in as much as possible. And so, yeah, you see, there's a lot of Christians who believe it is necessary to our duty to love our neighbors ourselves to be involved, because the institution exists and it's necessary for human flourishing.
Well, I want to circle back to, we've just alluded to it a few times in the podcast, the topic of abortion, which you speak and write about regularly, which your ministry has a focus on. And how does that particular topic, the abortion argument, offer an example of everything, really, and some of this conflict we've been talking about? Because that's exactly what is said on the other side for people who would reject Christianity having any impact, because they would say, it's my body. You are imposing your morals on my body. This should be a decision between myself and my doctor. It has nothing to do with the state, has nothing to do with the church. And so therefore, this is the classic example of Christians feeling that they can shove their religion down the throats of everyone else who don't even believe in it.
Absolutely. It's a fair objection that has to be answered on our side, right? And it's deeply personal. And that's what, for the 50 years of Roe v. Wade, it was the idea of it being personal that grounded the Roe v. Wade decision. This is a deeply personal issue. This is nobody else's business. And it was very focused on doctors, oddly enough, but this is a deeply personal medical issue. And you're trying to, when I stand up there, they're thinking of this as something they have a right to do, that has to do with their bodily autonomy, with the free will to make decisions about how they're going to live their life. And then here is this man standing in front of them and saying, the law ought to restrict the practice of abortion. And they're saying, that's because you believe the unborn or something, but I reject what you're saying. I don't believe your biblical beliefs. Number one, and this is, I alluded to this earlier, but I want to state it explicitly now. None of us that I work with, the people that I've worked with over the years, or the philosophers that I follow, none of us, when we go out into the public and make a case against abortion, none of us appeal to the Bible. When we're trying to convince somebody who disagrees with us, I am not out there talking about the Bible. I may talk about that some when I'm speaking to church groups and I'm trying to talk to them about getting them motivated to engage this issue. But when I'm at a place where I get the opportunity, for example, years ago when I spoke at Harvard Hall, or when I go to any university or any school and I have a room full of people there and I have the opportunity to try to convince them that abortion is a moral wrong, I do it on two fronts. I argue that science demonstrates that from the moment they come into existence, the unborn are a human being. that they're human. It's a human life we're talking about. And this is inarguable. Right now, tell them, like at this point, because of the work of a guy by the name of Steve Jacobs in his PhD research at University of Chicago, where he established that academic biologists, the overwhelming majority of which are pro-choice and not believers, say that over 96% affirm that life begins at conception, right? At fertilization, that's when a life begins. So look, biologically speaking, a human life begins at the moment that it comes into existence. Do we have a human being, a human life? And now the question of when does that life become valuable is a philosophical question. And we have to just look at different views of how we determine human life and see which one of them is the most just and which one of them is the most likely to ground a society that is going to contribute to human flourishing. There's a Christopher Tolleson, a philosopher at University of South Carolina that I interviewed about a book that he wrote called The Way of Medicine that he co-wrote, where they were talking about the way medicine is practiced today. And we were talking about the different objections of people who get mad when they say you're forcing your religious belief on us about what human beings are. And offhandedly, while he and I were chatting, I said, the hardest part is convincing them that they would rather live in a world where all human beings were treated with dignity and respect. Besides whatever they want to get away with at the moment, or whether they want to do that would be forbidden in that kind of a world, that it would be better for all, even them, if we live in that world. So this is deeply personal to them. So why do I get to be intrusive? Number one, I'm offering an argument based in science and philosophy about what it means to be human and what kind of human life ought to be treated with dignity and respect. I believe those arguments are better than anything they have to counter. Now, as a result of that, then we're placed into a world where we realize that we don't have the freedom to destroy other human beings for being inconvenient. Now, I have recognized in writing and in talk for years that pregnancy is a strange place, and it's one of the weirdest places at the intersection of law and faith and belief and philosophy and all of those things, because it is the intersection of two human lives in a way that will never happen again throughout a person's lifetime. They are located inside another human being, and that's weird, and I acknowledge that. But it is also the way every human being who has ever existed throughout all of human history came into existence. And so once you are given a way of seeing human beings that says, look, if we're to the most consistent way for us to ground things like equal dignity and equal value, these are things that are principles that are important to Western view of human beings that has been very successful, then we just recognize that we're limited to the kind of things that we can do to other human beings. This isn't a religious expression, although I am a deeply religious individual, and although it's sourced out of that is my commitment to love my neighbor as myself. But even those people who reject everything that I believe as Christians, like an atheist like Teresa Bukanovic, who's running for the Democratic presidency right now against Joe Biden, obviously that's not a very successful campaign she's running, but she's out there running it for the express purpose for her to be able to say, it doesn't take being a Christian to say we shouldn't kill other human beings, and it doesn't take being a Christian to recognize that life before it's born is a human being that deserves to live without our killing it for being inconvenient. And so this isn't putting or oppressing human beings and interjecting ourselves into their personal choices with a religion that they reject. It's actually, hopefully, when you do it best, it's helping them to see that treating all human life as valuable is consistent with what they already believe about human relationships. They just haven't thought about it as an extension with the unborn. And that if they embrace this, yes, it will place certain limitations on their own behavior, but the payoff for accepting those limitations is that we have a society better ordered to produce human flourishing for everybody in it. So that's when I say, when you see the intersection here, as a deeply religious individual with Christian beliefs and motivated by the idea that all human beings ought to be treated with dignity because they're image bearers of God, and that I should pursue that in the public sector because I'm commanded to love my neighbor as myself, my job is not to convince them to accept Christianity at this point. My job is to convince them to accept the idea that all human beings should be treated with dignity and respect. By extension, by the way, a friend of mine, Tina Whittington, a student of Life of America, once gave me this phrase. She said, talking about abortion is a gateway drug for the gospel. Because as soon as they start hearing all of these things about value and dignity and respect, and as soon as they realize they believe those things, that almost everyone that you're talking to believes that we shouldn't kill other human beings unless we absolutely have to. And once you get into those conversations, they start to ask other questions about where does these beliefs come from? And it does lead to gospel opportunities that you won't get if you just stay out of the fight. And by the way, I've had them. I've had so many conversations. One of the funniest things that I think happens after I get done speaking at a school where I talk about philosophy and I talk about science and I never talk about my faith. If I talk at schools, oftentimes in Christian schools, the teachers will come up to me or the president of the school or the principal of the school will come up to me and they would say, these group of students would like to talk to you. I have talked to their teachers and they are allowed to stay with you as long as you're willing to stay and answer every question that they have. And you know who those students are that they brought to me? The ones who are struggling with their faith, who have deep questions, and they want the chance to talk to them about, talk to me about those. And so by getting up and making a case for the value of human life, I've opened up the door to defend the gospel to a group of young people who are in a Christian school but are struggling with their beliefs. And I have been given an audience with them because they see me as reasonable in a way that they may not see other people as reasonable, fair or not. And that gives me the opportunity to share the gospel with them in a direct way that I would never have had I not been there championing the unborn in front of that audience.
So you've talked a few times about loving our neighbor as ourself, and I just want to read a passage that has Jesus talking about that for our listeners. That would be found in Luke 10:27, which says, "And he answered, 'You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself.'" So how can Christians love our neighbors, you know, as Jesus commanded us to do, just read from Luke, the Gospel of Luke, and engage in politics in a manner that's really interpreted as being very exasperating to our neighbor, to the person who doesn't share our same beliefs, or they would say that maybe our beliefs are making them feel oppressed. So how's that loving to them when I'm saying that I don't agree with something in my mind, your neighbor's mind, that is their own personal right to do with their own body?
It's very hard to be told you're wrong. And I remember talking to a young man years ago, and he and I were chatting. His father asked me to talk to him. He rejected belief in the Bible. He'd rejected belief in Christianity. And we were having a conversation that was a far-reaching 2-hour-long lunch. And at one point, I could see him getting very stressed. And I remember raising my hands and saying, you know, I didn't want this to be a stressful conversation. I wanted this to be a respectful conversation about important things. If this is bothering you, we don't have to keep having this conversation. He said, it's not you. He said, it's just hard starting to consider that everything that you believe is wrong. I'm just wrestling with that as we have this conversation. And you see this, right? So what I would say, the first thing that we have to do is remember why we engage. I don't care that Jay wins anything. I care that the truth gets spread. And I think that if we remember why we're engaging, going back to those guys that I talked to last week, that we had that conversation. And one of the things that we had discussed in that conversation was that we have to be comfortable with the idea that we have a responsibility and duty to advocate for the truth, but that we may lose. Right. And that losing doesn't make us crazy, because our job is to represent the truth. Our job is to fight as best we can for the truth. Our job is to spread the truth. As somebody who used to be an atheist when I was younger, I can say I reacted very angrily when Christians came to me and talked to me about the things that I was doing. I was very defensive about what they said to me about how I was living my life. I was very defensive about Christian interference in politics, what I would have seen at that time as interference in politics. And I now, from where I'm sitting, am so grateful to God, to every Christian that was willing to absorb the abuse that they got by coming to me to talk to me about these things. I'm grateful for every Christian that was out there fighting for a just society, even though I didn't see them as doing so on this side of things. Because when I was there, I was not living in accordance with the truth. And those people who were willing to endure the storm of my derision, right? They did good work that ultimately led to me being able to be on this side of things and to act out of love for Christ first, for God first, and then love for my neighbor second. And the great thing about that, if you go and you quoted from Luke, in the article, I quote from the Gospel of Matthew 22:30, where it says all the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. You know, I do this personally. I have this evaluation when I feel like things are not going right, or I've lost the narrative or what I'm supposed to be doing. I say, let's simplify this, Jay. Am I loving God with everything that I have, with all of my being? Have I laid myself out on the altar of God? Am I loving my neighbor as myself? Because that's where I'm getting everything right. And so one of the things I've always encouraged audiences over the last few years, post-COVID, I started giving this talk, where I would say we are at our best when our neighborhood is expansive, when we have an expansive view of what it means to be our neighbor, when we are looking for opportunities to love our neighbor, even the people that we don't immediately understand as our neighbor. And then let's go back for me, and we're talking about abortion. There are two people that I am looking at, two groups of human beings that I'm looking at that are my neighbor, and that I see I am in service to by spreading this message that all human beings ought to be treated with dignity and respect, even if it means passing laws that people feel like unfairly restrict their personal decisions. The first is obviously the unborn, because your personal decisions are destroying life. And they have nothing to say about it because they can't speak for themselves. But that doesn't mean that they're not human. And it doesn't mean that we're just in killing them. It just means that they can't object. And so I'll object on their behalf. So they're my neighbor. And I fight for the unborn because they're my neighbor and I love them as I love myself. And because even though I am not going to be the victim of abortion anytime in the near future, they are daily the victims of abortion. And so in loving them as I love myself, I give my voice to them as if it were my very own life pleading for it. That's the best I can offer them. But the second thing is, the people who are living in a lie are my neighbor. And they will be better served. Christianity is better. I know it. I've experienced it. It's better. If I can help them to see that, if I can help them see the light, if I can help them see the love of God, if I can help them see an inclusive view of human value, if I can help them expand their neighborhood, if I can help them to live in accordance with the truth, I serve them as well. So how can we do this? I think as best we can, we remember why we're doing it and we remember who's included in our neighborhood. It's not just the victims of bad ideas. We're all victims of bad ideas. The whole of society is victim of bad ideas once they become laws. It's everyone, even those people who hate me, who I know Christianity would be better for them, even if they don't see it, even if they don't know it, even if they're not willing to examine it. They are my neighbor, and I am to love them in a radical way that was commanded by God, as if their concerns and their worries and their problems were my very own. And I know I fail at this every day. I know I do. I fail at it all the time, but that's not an excuse to quit trying. And that means I have to love them through every means that's been given to me to do so. And that includes trying to help them and all of us live under just laws as much as it's possible for me to do.
You noted that the title of your article is Christianity is Better. You're just talking about that. So what are some of the, maybe impending issues that you believe this approach that Christianity is better is really positioned to help the Christian navigate some of those views that you think are going to come up? And just kind of expand on that a little bit more, because again, even the phrase that Christianity is better, people would say, well, again, you're trying to impose your morals on me. But as Christians, believing that Christianity is better, how can that equip us for some future issues coming up?
Yeah. And I'd say, number one, let's go back to the imposing of moral. By saying Christianity is better, I actually don't think that is an imposition. I think that's an offering of a comparison. Right? But let's put them all out there. Put them all out there. Put every view out there. Give everybody the chance to voice their views and let people see them fully. And let's not poison the well by saying religious beliefs ought to be excluded. And let's not prejudice the battlefield by saying some people get a pass and other people aren't allowed to express their views. I think by saying Christianity is better, we're actually just offering an option. And all we're saying is we need the opportunity to express ourselves fully so that we can make our case that this is better. And what other ways will it serve? And I think in everything that we have coming, I mean, when you're talking about the advancement of science, medical science, I've written articles for you about human-animal chimera research. We've talked about physician-assisted suicide. We talk about transhumanism. We've talked about the idea of people who are actively trying to move human life and human beings past this human stage and to transform us into something else through an integration of humanity and technology. We talk about the advancement of AI and the idea of even if we were to accept all of the good that AI can do, we have to recognize that AI is creating a level of stress on our brothers and sisters. And so we have a duty or responsibility to engage it, not from the idea that AI will, for like a post-humanist or a transhumanist, it would say AI is going to turn us into something else, and that's great. But from the view of being able to say, our devotion to the value of human life can be a bulwark against allowing AI to become something that it shouldn't become, as long as we're always looking at this through the lens that our brothers and sisters, other human lives, matter. And then when we talk about the things, Tom Holland, a secular, non-Christian historian, in his book Dominion, tries to make the case that Christianity tamed the world largely. And he gives up, it's a survey of human history through this idea of the taming effect of Christianity on the world. I think, you know, in one place where he hits it very squarely on the head is where he said, Christianity brings with it a devotion to the weak that just does not exist in other worldviews. The idea that we serve God by taking care of those who cannot take care of themselves, that Christianity brought that in a way that the world had never seen and introduced it. Now, the power of having communities committed to Christianity, combined with this view that the low people deserve to be treated better, made the whole world better, according to Tom Holland, who rejects Christianity as the truth. I saw this personally with a friend of mine who was a Christian, who I went back to, we were doing a mission trip in a largely Muslim land in Indonesia. And when he and I were talking, I said, what was it like for you when you came to the United States? And he said, you know, what was the most startling thing to me was the way you guys care for people who can't take care of themselves. He said, where I grew up, if you had issues that made it so you couldn't contribute, you were just cast aside, ignored. You just were not paid attention to. And I saw this, by the way, in some small villages when I've traveled around the world and had the opportunity to preach the gospel in these places. You'll go into these villages and you'll see a kid sitting in a wheelchair or somebody dealing with somebody, and they're just sitting there and nobody's paying any attention to them. He said, then I came to the United States and y'all made such an effort. Y'all were doing so much to take care of people, and it was startling to me, he said. It startled me. So when you talk about what Christianity offers as far as a devotion to the importance of human life, the ideas of mercy and justice balancing against each other, that we can't just go full in and destroy our enemies, because our enemies are not the people. We're trying to win those people over to Christ. We want them to be restored to a right relationship. It's our plan is not their destruction, but their redemption and their salvation. And all of these things are things that serve us well as we get into the ability to manipulate biology in a way that's never been seen before in human history, to take liberties with life in a way that has never been seen before in human history, to question the very destiny of humanity in a way that's never been experienced before in human history. A robust view of what it means to be human, grounded in the Imago Dei and the value of and the equal dignity of all human life, and to love our neighbors as ourselves. This is something that will protect all of us as we go forward, even those who don't agree with that view at this point or not. It's a way to create a better world, not a perfect world. There will be no perfect world this side of heaven, but a better world than one where human beings are seen as disposable or as a problem to be overcome.
So do you think that we can make the case to folks who reject Christianity that Christianity is better without, you know, you talked a bit about that, but without making them feel oppressed by even the idea of Christianity is better, by saying we're giving them an option, but they still might think that in the option that we're giving, it sounds oppressive. It sounds like we're trying to give them an option that's requiring them to impose morals on other people.
Yeah. I don't think you'll ever, I mentioned earlier the idea that laws wouldn't exist if we could convince 100% of the people of the good of any particular viewpoint. The reason the laws exist is because we recognize we'll never convince 100% of the people to do good. And so we have to put in place systems to restrict the behavior of people and to be able to punish them when they do something that the law says they shouldn't be able to do. So no, I don't think we'll ever be able to quiet every loud voice that's worried about our interference. I 100%, by the way, do agree with them on some level or another. The championing of the Christian views of equal dignity of human value is going to limit their ability to make certain decisions that they have decided and the government has decided for a while there, and in some places still does, and that culture has decided that are perfectly legitimate things that they're allowed to do, that ultimately we do limit behavior all over the place. And that's always been a helpful way for people to see that when we're talking to them, there is a reaction. I remember one young lady stood up in San Francisco and she started getting, she got very angry with me about the idea of saying that there were certain things that she wasn't allowed to choose to do. And then I was able to lay out several other things that she's not allowed to choose. I said, for example, I said, you know, you believe that women ought to be able to have to make free decisions without the interference of the state of the community. She said, yes. Well, should you be allowed to choose to walk across this room to see the possessions of one of your classmates that you really like, to seize those possessions for yourself without any compensation and without the approval of the person you took them from? And she said, no, of course not. Well, why not? Because that would be stealing. I said, and stealing is what? Wrong. I said, wrong and illegal. So, and then we can go through this with people. And I do, I go through this with them and say, look, there are cases where you already accept that it is perfectly legitimate for your choices to be limited and that you don't see this as an inclusion or a burden of somebody else's morality, largely because you see yourself in some sense of principle of reciprocity. You don't want people stealing from you. So you think it's okay to object to you stealing. The problem here is not that you think it's okay to kill human beings. The problem is in the case of like abortion, that you just don't think they are human. So let's talk about what you think they are, which is a question I asked them. If we both agree that we shouldn't be able to kill people, we shouldn't be able to steal things, we shouldn't be able to rape people, all of these things that we agree, and all of those things we agree that people should be restricted from doing and they should be punished for doing. So let's ask why you think this one's different than that one. And then I think we're open ourselves up to all sorts of reasonable conversations because we are oftentimes operating on a shared value system. They just don't realize it. They don't realize how much the things that they value are grounded in views, as Tom Holland would point out, that just could not exist in society without the haunting, the Christian haunting of society, so to speak, the Christ haunting of society. If we weren't still living in some way or another as if we believed these things, as we start to jettison them, or as culture starts to jettison them one at a time, then society as we live in it would suddenly become impossible. So even Tom Holland, and he's not the only one, there's lots of secular writers that have written this that say, look, it may just very well be that Christian ethics are something we can't get rid of and still have an ordered society because they're so good. And so if I help them to see that these things that are grounded in these beliefs that you're rejecting out of hand because you see them as intrusive to your personal decisions, you already accept limits on your personal decisions. We're just talking about one more, and we have a really, really, really good reason for talking about that and for wanting that restriction. And that reason, if we embrace it, will protect you from future abuse. I'm reminded of Hadley Arkus talking about in his debates with Stephen Douglas about slavery, where he said to be careful about the arguments that you're making as Abraham Lincoln's making as Stephen Douglas. Hadley Arkus writes that Lincoln said to Douglas, be careful about the arguments you make for slavery because they can be turned back on you. Every argument that you make to justify keeping them as a slave can be turned around to be used to enslave you at some future date. You have to be careful. Better to admit that slavery is wrong and protect us all, and that you have to give up this one thing. And that's the kind of arguments that we can have. So no, we will never, ever stop hearing the people who are angry with us on some level or another. But our job is not to convince everyone. Our job is to convince enough people to make as just a society as we possibly can, that the very morals that they're rejecting because they see them as Christian by nature are oftentimes morals that they're already to some degree or another accepting and living by. And that if they just embrace the full force of that morality and that ethic as Christ defined it, it would be better for everyone.
Well, I hope our listeners have been challenged by some of the things that we talked about today. And so I want to end on a much lighter note. So finally, I have a fun question for Jay. Jay, March 1st is National Peanut Butter Lovers Day. So PB&J or Reese's Peanut Butter Cups?
I am as big a peanut butter person as you will ever meet in your life, meaning that there is no, almost all foods are some way or another. I eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches all the time. Reese's peanut butter cups are my favorite candy or sweet to eat. Also nutty bars or nutty buddies from Little Debbie. I am just a peanut butter nut. I eat peanut butter filled pretzels. I cannot get enough of peanut butter. So there is no delivery of peanut butter that I reject. Every single delivery of peanut butter to me works. I have no idea. We joke about this in the family because I have no idea how it ever happened, but I would be happy to eat peanut. I think I do eat peanut butter every day and I'm happy to do so. I am happy to eat peanut butter crackers, peanut butter jelly sandwiches, peanut butter candies, everything. Peanut butter just makes me happy. I am a peanut butter nut.
Well, thanks for being a guest today on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to episode 381 from the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest was Jay Watts, and he has written an online exclusive feature article for the Christian Research Journal, and Jay's article is called Christianity is Better, What Place for the Christian in a Post-Christian Political World? And you can read his article for free at our website, equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Handegraff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.